So good afternoon. It's good to see so many members and their guests here today for Mr. Wolfstahl's rescheduled talk. Sorry he had to reschedule it, but he had COVID at the time. We didn't think he wanted to come, and we didn't think we wanted him to come. And I'd like to also welcome those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. The Midcoast Forum was founded in 1983, and this is the 453rd meeting with a foreign affairs expert invited to speak and answer questions on an issue critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. The Midcoast Forum's website, midcoastforum.org, contains audios of past forum talks and information about upcoming forum speakers. Audios of our speakers are also now available on the Maine Monitor website, mainmonitor.org. If you're interested in keeping informed about key affairs issues, you will find our membership form on our website, and we do hope that you'll join us, and we hope that guests that are here today will enjoy it enough that they'll become permanent members. Today, we are pleased to have Mr. John Wolfstahl with us to speak on "Is a New Era of Nuclear Danger Upon Us?" Mr. John Wolfstahl is a leading authority on nuclear weapons policy, regional proliferation, arms control, and nuclear deterrence. He is a senior advisor for policy and advocacy at Global Zero, the international movement for nuclear abolition. He is also a fellow at Harvard University's Belfer Center and at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is a member of the board of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and of the State Department's International Security Advisory Board. From 2014 to 2017, Mr. Wolfstahl served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Arms Control and Nonproliferation at the National Security Council, which was the most senior White House position setting and implementing U.S. policy on arms control, nonproliferation, and nuclear weapons. Prior to that, he served as the Deputy Director of the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies out in California. From 2009 to 2012, Mr. Wolfstahl served simultaneously as a special advisor to Vice President Biden for nuclear security and nonproliferation, and as director for nonproliferation on the National Security Council. Mr. Wolfstahl has been a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, deputy director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has served in several capacities at the Department of Energy. His work has included assignments in Russia and North Korea, as well as travel to Iran, and he has written dozens of scholarly articles and opinion pieces, and has appeared on or been quoted in most leading domestic and international news media outlets. John, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thanks, George. Thanks. So now I have to live up to the most dynamic person George Look has ever met. That's tough. Let me start by saying thank you to the Midcoast Forum. I'm really happy to be here. I'm also particularly happy that I was able to come up at the invitation of George and Karen Look. For those of you that haven't worked in the U.S. government, a little insight, the position that I had at the White House from 2014 to 2017 was senior director at the National Security Council. That's the job that George had when I was the director. And if you can add, senior director is more important than the director. So I have this reflex when I get an email from George Look, I immediately sit up and respond in the positive, yes, I can do that. Fortunately, this time it was an invitation to come to Maine as opposed to where's that paper that's due in 12 minutes and why did you misspell the word nuclear? I really appreciate people being willing to come up, especially in Maine on a fairly nice, almost spring day, on a Monday, to talk about a really depressing set of issues. But in the United States, organizations like this are endangered. There have been for 100 years 75 years, UN associations and World Affairs councils and foreign relations groups, and increasingly they are less dynamic. Older Americans were much more interested in how the world worked and their role in it, and these opportunities are shrinking. And so I really just want to start by applauding you for maintaining your interest. If I lived up in Maine and could be kayaking or snowshoeing, I don't know that I'd want to hear about nuclear weapons on a Monday, but you're here and lunch is already paid for, so we'll go through it and talk about it. This is a very difficult and in many ways daunting set of issues. They're also a particularly arcane set of issues. If you don't work in nuclear policy, some of the logic, and I'll use air quotes, is not very obvious to people. And when we debate these issues in policy circles, and then we go out and try and explain it to the public, we often get either dazed looks or your crazy looks, or people's eyes glaze over, because these are long-standing, difficult problems. When we would work, both George and I, for the president, he would often say, if it was an easy problem, it would have been solved before it got to my desk. The fact that we're sitting here 70 years after nuclear weapons were invented suggests that this is a persistent and pernicious problem that we have yet to solve. Now, we'll talk a little bit about the fact that there are some people who think nuclear weapons aren't a problem at all, that in fact they're additive and beneficial to our security, but that's part of the debate that we continue to have in Washington and around the world. My views will become pretty clear, I think, over time. But the basic challenge as I see it, and I think as most people would come to define it, is that nuclear weapons can be used by people to enhance their perceived security. The United States, having invented nuclear weapons, being the only country to use nuclear weapons in warfare, has maintained for many years that nuclear weapons are the ultimate guarantor of our security, and we use them to not only prevent nuclear attack against ourselves, but we extend this protection to our allies in Europe and in Asia and elsewhere so that they will not be subject to either nuclear or other attack. And so in that world, nuclear weapons are good. We're the good guys, we're trying to prevent wars, the bad guys are going to come at us, and nuclear weapons can prevent that. At the same time, the other side of that coin is that nuclear weapons remain really the only weapon that could rapidly destroy humanity. As Einstein said, we need to eliminate nuclear weapons before they eliminate us. Now, human beings develop all sorts of horrible things, and whether they're biological weapons or chemical agents, I don't happen to think that cybersecurity will necessarily kill every American or every human being just because we can't get to the internet, although my 13-year-old thinks, of course, that would be the case. The fact is that nuclear weapons still remain the most powerful weapon that humanity has ever invented and can do vastly more destruction than human beings are capable of understanding. These are not really large conventional explosives. These are different types of weapons that have different effects and that can have global implications even if only a few are used. And so this debate, well, should we keep them because they protect us or we should get rid of them because they're dangerous, is what forms the basis for nuclear policy debates in the United States over the last 70 years. The people who invented nuclear weapons in the Manhattan Project were strongly set against using nuclear weapons against Japan. They argued that, in fact, the first use of nuclear weapons should be a demonstration test so that we would show the Japanese what we had developed and they would surrender. And that was decided against because what if it didn't work? What if we said, look at this spot in this day and nothing happened? And so ever since nuclear weapons were invented, there's a debate about what's their appropriate role. And that's actually, I view it as a positive. We should be debating these issues. And one of the challenges is that over the last 30 years, nuclear weapons have faded into the background. The danger has always been there. We still have over 12,500 nuclear weapons in the world. Now, we came down from about 70,000 nuclear weapons in the late 1960s, early 1970s, but the fact remains that 12,500 nuclear weapons can not only ruin your day, but my day and his day and her day and everybody else's day. That's more than enough to destroy the Earth's population many times over. So we have to understand these issues. We have to understand how these weapons can be used. We have to understand whether or not we're able to prevent these weapons from spreading, from being used, and can we in fact eliminate them? And that's the happy topic that we'll talk about for the next 20 minutes or so. There are a lot of different countries that have nuclear weapons. There are currently 9 countries in possession of nuclear weapons. I'm happy to talk in the question and answer about some of the related issues around Iran or North Korea or South Asia. What I'm really going to focus on is what I see as the growing problem between the United States and Russia and China, because that nuclear set of relationships is going to define over the next 50 years the nuclear weapons landscape. If we are going to eliminate nuclear weapons anytime in the foreseeable future, it will be because the United States and Russia and China have agreed that these weapons are not usable, that they are more dangerous than the value that they add, and that we will agree politically to eliminate them. If we do that, then I have optimism that you can convince the other countries of the world to see that logic and come along. But if we get that set of relationships wrong, we are very likely to see a replay of the arms race cycles that led to the United States and Soviet Union having 70,000 nuclear weapons. And in fact, I can imagine the United States, Russia, and China having many, many more weapons than that, because in addition to the territorial challenges of Russian expansion and NATO protection, we also have the belief that China is looking to rewrite the global security order, including to rewrite the borders in East Asia and elsewhere. And in that environment where nuclear weapons are seen as beneficial and stabilizing, every move we make will have to be matched by these two adversaries, and every move they make will be seen as a challenge to the United States demanding a response. And if you don't believe me, I can tell you that right now there's an office in the Pentagon crashing to develop a new set of surveillance balloons, because of course we live in a world where the Chinese have balloon superiority, as we just saw several weeks ago, and I guarantee you that there's a crash course to develop surveillance balloons in the Pentagon. So let's take these issues one at a time. In the case of Russia, and I think many of you are here in part because even if you thought the nuclear weapons set of issues had sort of faded to the background, Ukraine and the invasion was a wake-up call. George and Karen and I talked last night about how people could not imagine that we would have a conventional war in the heart of Europe, right? And we can even less imagine that one of the actors in that country would be actively and repeatedly threatening to use nuclear weapons in order to protect his conventional invasion of a sovereign state. So that has reignited the issue, in many different ways, right? Many of you probably heard the reports about Russia shelling the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. I wrote a piece that talked about how launching artillery shells in a nuclear power plant was a really, really, really dumb idea. It seemed to be logically supported, but for Russia, capturing critical infrastructure and power production infrastructure is a key part of their invasion plan. But really what has captured the world's attention is the fact that Russia and President Putin has said openly that we have nuclear weapons and we are prepared to use them if NATO gets involved directly in the fighting in Ukraine, and at times has said that we would consider using nuclear weapons if the United States escalates by sending tanks or planes or expanding NATO to these countries. We've seen repeated statements that nuclear weapons are on the table. Having worked for President Biden, I was not surprised that his response was relatively mild, because he, among all of the people in the U.S. government, has lived long enough to remember what it was like in the 1960s and 70s and 80s when you had periods where things could escalate quickly between the United States and Soviet Union. And nobody needs to be reminded that the United States has nuclear weapons. Russia knows very well that we have the capability to respond. And what he has tried to do, I think rightly, is not play into the narrative that Putin is creating, that this is a war between NATO and the United States. That if we have to respond to every nuclear statement Putin makes, that doesn't necessarily influence his decision making. All it does is
worry our European allies that, yes, this might in fact become a nuclear war, which is what he's really trying to do. He's trying to use the threat of nuclear escalation to keep the Europeans on the sidelines so that Ukraine has to stand alone so that he can prevail. Now, ironically, for those of you that were paying attention in the late 1980s and early 1990s, you might remember that we had this something called the Soviet Union, and that the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, and that one of the things that happened was that the Soviet Union had left about 1,900 nuclear weapons on Ukrainian territory when it no longer existed. And the number one U.S. objective coming out of the fall of the Soviet Union was to make sure that only one country, Russia, maintained control over those nuclear weapons. Because it wasn't just Ukraine, there were also nuclear weapons that were left in Kazakhstan and also in Belarus. And our process of recognizing Ukraine and Belarus and Kazakhstan and the Baltics as independent states was built around our insistence that all of the nuclear weapons had to be returned to Russia. And by 1994, Ukraine had agreed, and all nuclear weapons that were deployed on their territory were in fact returned. So it's even worse that Russia has invaded Ukraine under the threat of nuclear weapons, because we're the ones that helped convince Ukraine that they should not try to get these weapons. So why does this matter? Well, one, it sort of takes the veil off of, or the sheen off of, President Putin, to the extent that there's been any sheen left, to remind us of exactly what he is and what he's trying to do. He's trying to use pure military force to dominate his near abroad and to try to recreate, to the extent he can, the former Soviet Empire. And it doesn't matter to him whether Russians, Ukrainians, or other people die in order to achieve that. But to do that through the use of nuclear weapons against a country that, from our view, did the right thing and gave up the potential to be a nuclear weapon state has major implications for how the rest of the world looks at nuclear weapons. And I wrote a piece in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago that said, look, I would like us to help Ukraine defeat Russia, and quickly. But the faster that defeat comes, the more likely Putin actually reaches for his nuclear deterrent. Just as we would have done if the Soviet Union had streamed across the inter-German border and overrun our conventional forces, our policy was that we are prepared to use nuclear weapons to destroy Soviet tank formations as they come across. Now, we were playing defense, Putin's playing offense, but he is using the same logic that in a failing conventional war, he has the ability and the willingness and even the right to use nuclear weapons to defend himself. The fact that he's invaded this country and into Ukrainian territory sort of gets pushed to the sidelines. So if Putin succeeds, he will have used nuclear weapons to his advantage, and that then becomes a model that other countries can follow, whether that's North Korea or China against Taiwan. If he is losing quickly and reaches for nuclear weapons and uses them to prevent defeat, then we're in a whole new world. If he uses nuclear weapons against Ukraine, or God forbid against NATO territory, the risk of escalation is quite severe. And so unfortunately for the Ukrainians, the only option that we have that allows them to win is a slow victory, one where Putin loses slowly enough that he doesn't feel it forces the collapse of his regime, but he recognizes that he can't use nuclear weapons to prevent that from happening. Now, I can't guarantee that's the outcome, but I worry less about that from a nuclear point of view than I do about him losing quickly or him using a nuclear weapon to achieve his purpose. So all of those factors suggest to me that from this example alone, unless Putin loses, nuclear weapons are going to become much more relevant both to Putin, because his conventional capabilities have been shown to be, in a word, terrible. A colleague in Washington says Russia's the second best army in Ukraine, let alone in Europe. Corey Shockey gets credit for that, so I don't want to trademark her catchphrase. And so in a world where they are conventionally inferior, we can expect them to rely increasingly on their nuclear weapons capabilities. Now, all of this is happening in a larger negative dynamic with Russia. It's not just about Ukraine. And for a minute, I'll talk about what that suggests for the future of U.S.-Russian nuclear affairs. You don't know it, but you have a celebrity here. George Look was one of the key people that helped negotiate the New START arms control treaty with Russia in 2010, was the head of the National Security Council office that led that effort, has a famous picture drinking champagne with President Obama. I missed that, and yes, I'm a little bitter. but under that treaty, both the United States and Russia are limited to no more than 1,550 strategic offensively deployed nuclear weapons. I won't explain exactly what that means, but let's just call it 1,500 among friends. And both sides agreed to accept inspections by the other side to ensure that, in fact, they are not deploying more strategic weapons than are allowed under the treaty. And they're also limited to a certain number of deployed missiles. They exchange data every 6 months. Every time they move a submarine or a missile or a nuclear weapon from here to there, it has to get documented and shared. Russia just announced a couple weeks ago that they are suspending implementation of that treaty. And so we are seeing a sea change in Russian nuclear behavior, not just on the ground, but a change in Russian behavior from what we saw even during the Cold War and during the existence of the Soviet Union. And one of the factors or the features of the Cold War that surprises people is that even while we were pointing nuclear weapons against each other and preparing to fight conventional war in Europe, the United States and Soviet Union actually cooperated very effectively to prevent other countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. We helped support the negotiation of an important international treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We worked together on regional non-proliferation challenges on North Korea in the early days to prevent countries like Iran or South Africa or others from acquiring nuclear capabilities. And we actually agreed with the Soviet Union on restricting access to civilian nuclear technology that was particularly useful in acquiring nuclear weapons. Now, this is a country that said we were capitalist pigs that deserved to die, and they were godless communists that we were prepared to incinerate. But we recognized that we shouldn't let other people create a fight that we didn't want. We wanted to sort of keep the lid on those regional non-proliferation aspirants so the big boys could keep arguing amongst themselves. That dynamic, where the Russian leadership recognizes that we have mutual interests and can cooperate even as we compete and our adversaries and others, is gone. We no longer cooperate with Russia on counterterrorism. We no longer cooperate with Russia on environmental protection and climate change. And we no longer cooperate with Russia on non-proliferation, preventing countries like Iran from acquiring nuclear capabilities, and in maintaining some basic semblance of strategic stability when nuclear weapons come into play. The way we talk about this is Vladimir Putin has decided that he wants to weaponize risk. We are a status quo power. The world works for us. The United States helped write the international economic global security order, and as long as that's maintained, we largely continue to prosper. Russia has decided that system no longer works for them. They are an anti-status quo power, and they are prepared to create risk and instability if for no other reason than to make it hard for us to succeed. And in the nuclear realm, that makes it very hard to avoid very small conflicts from growing out of control. And if you don't believe me, just look at the downing of a US drone over the Black Sea 2 weeks ago by a Russian aircraft. We worked very hard for decades to make sure that Russian aircraft didn't come into close proximity with American aircraft, and that American ships didn't come into close proximity with Russian ships. And if they did, the commanders were trained to know what frequency to communicate on via radio, whether they passed to the right or to the left, what were the rules of the road. We no longer have those in place with Russia. And so even if the leaders don't want to get into a bind, a plane can act in a way that threatens our interests, our ships can act in ways that threaten Russian interests, and things can quickly spiral. So into that world, pour the fact that Russia is now conventionally weak and building new innovative ways of delivering nuclear weapons against their targets, including long-range underwater drones, nuclear-powered, nuclear-tipped cruise missiles that can fly around the world 3 or 4 times before landing on target. They haven't perfected these things yet, but they're developing them, in part because they worry the United States is going to get really good at building national defenses against nuclear-tipped missiles. Those of you that were around might remember Ronald Reagan gave a speech in 1983, famous Star Wars speech, we're going to make nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. That program of building missile defenses never went away. We've spent about $300 billion on that program over the last 40 years. We have all of 44 missile interceptors based in Alaska and California. They might work, they might not, nobody wants to say for sure, but Russia has about 500 missiles. So they know that they could overwhelm an American missile defense system, but our missile defenses are getting better. And we also have the ability to use conventional and nuclear offensive strike against Russia in a crisis. They know that. And so they worry increasingly that they no longer have a deterrent, the ability to say to the United States, don't attack us or you will be destroyed. Insanely, that is still the basis for nuclear stability between the United States and Russia. Don't do anything stupid or we'll have to do the same. And so Russia wants to make sure they can maintain this nuclear capability. We work very hard to maintain a capability that can't be destroyed rapidly out of the blue. And so as Russia is building these new capabilities, they look at the United States and see that we are embarked on a rather large nuclear modernization effort as well. Most people don't know this. We spend $50 billion a year in the United States to maintain and upgrade our nuclear forces. Now, in a nuclear budget that's coming up on $900 billion, it's not that much money, but it is still the largest nuclear modernization effort ever undertaken on the face of the planet. We are going to build a new generation of ICBMs, long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, a new generation of strategic ballistic missile submarines, a new generation of stealth nuclear-capable bombers, and deploying new nuclear capabilities that can be delivered by cruise missile or by fighter-bomber aircraft around the world. Now, we do that because we view our forces as stabilizing. Russia looks at it and says, you have the world's largest conventional military, especially compared to ours, which isn't so good, and you're embarked on a very large-scale nuclear modernization program, and we find ourselves very quickly in a cycle where both sides feel what the other is doing is undermining stability, and the other side needs to take steps to remedy it. Because we no longer have a basis of agreement that we'll cap the number of offensive systems, we will limit the defensive capabilities that other side has, and that will form the basis for a stable nuclear relationship. There are lots of different elements in that, but I think the greatest factor is the change that came about in 2002 when the United States decided that we were going to leave the treaty that limited both the United States and Russia to only 100 ballistic missile interceptors. We basically said from 1972 to 2002, we will leave both of our countries vulnerable to offensive nuclear strike. We're vulnerable to you, you're vulnerable to us, we don't like that, but it's better than us having an arms race where we're building thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons and trying to build defenses and taking our chances. The Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty formed the basis for that strategic understanding. And in 2002, we decided that we no longer wanted to be part of that bargain. We felt that it was a very different time with Russia. We felt that it was a very different time when we worried about missiles coming from Iran or North Korea, and that was the strategic decision that was made in 2002. But that loss of an understanding, a gentleman's agreement, for lack of a better term, is what adds to the negative dynamic that we currently see with Russia. And so I worry a lot about where that's going to go, and I think that's probably true whether Putin is in charge or Putin's successor. I don't think that will change very much depending on who's the Russian leader. So that's not depressing at all. Let's turn to the good news, China. If you watch the news and read just the headlines that come across your news feed or Twitter, you might have seen reports that China now has as many nuclear launchers as the United States. This was the result of a letter written by members of Congress to the head of U.S. Strategic Command asking what is the current status of Chinese nuclear forces. How many nuclear launchers do they have? And the head of Strategic Command wrote back a letter saying that, in fact, China has more strategic launchers than we do. Now, to your minds, unless you happen to be a nuclear expert, and we have several in the room, you might say, holy crap, China has more missiles and more nuclear weapons than... A nuclear launcher is defined by treaty between the United States and Russia as a hole in the ground capable of holding a missile. We don't count the missile, we count the hole in the ground. And China was recently revealed over the last couple of years as having built three large missile fields of silos out in the desert, 300 of them. Well, we have 450 ICBMs in the United States deployed in five states, 450 holes in the ground. China had about 175 holes in the ground previously. And you add to the 300 new holes in the ground, China has more strategic launchers than the United States. Let me calm you down for a second and say that while we are very concerned that China is embarked on a large-scale modernization and buildup of their nuclear forces, today the United States has about 3,800 nuclear weapons in our arsenal, and China has about 420. So almost 10 to 1. I'm not really good at math. Maybe it's 9 and 8.5 to 1, something like that. So I don't worry at night that China's going to say, oh, we got more launchers, U.S. better watch out. I also don't worry that a China, which is dependent on the United States for exports, for its access to the dollar, for the international economic system, is going to say, oh yeah, let's nuke the United States because we feel like it, right? What I worry about is that China is growing in terms of its conventional military and believes that the United States has been dominating the areas around China for too long, and China is beginning to assert itself based on its economic and growing military power. And that is coming into conflict with long-standing U.S. interests, including freedom of navigation in and around the region, and importantly, the protection of key U.S. allies, democracies in Japan and in South Korea, and, depending on how you want to define it and whether you want to get technical, Taiwan. Those issues where our interests are at stake and where China is saying its interests are at stake are increasingly coming into conflict. And so today, the United States can say, don't attack Taiwan, because if you do, we might use a nuclear weapon against you. Don't attack Japan, because if you do, we might use a nuclear weapon against you. That's actually our policy, by the way. It's not me just making it up. We say that if we were losing a conventional war or in the case of an existential threat to us or our allies, we are prepared to use nuclear weapons to respond, even first. Well, China says, huh, I got 400, you got 3,800. If I build up, would you still feel comfortable threatening to use nuclear weapons against us? Well, I don't know. We were prepared, at least we said politically, we were prepared to use nuclear weapons first against the Soviet Union when we both had about the same number of nuclear weapons. Was that credible? Did the Russians or Soviets believe it? We hoped so, but we never had any guarantees that they were 100% convinced. If you ask people that lived through that time, they say, well, they never attacked, so that must be pretty good evidence. But we don't have any intelligence or evidence even today that the Soviet Union wanted and planned to attack and control all of Europe. And in fact, much of the archival research demonstrates that the Soviets were paranoid that we were going to be able and capable of rolling through Warsaw Pact and invading Russia, which of course we never had plans to do, but both sides was paranoid about the capabilities of the other because we couldn't discern intent. And so we focused on capability instead. So I'm not here to tell you that, oh, we're misreading China and they're really nice people and we just want to get along. I don't believe that. I do worry that the Chinese view the current global landscape as working against their interests, and they now see they have a window of capability while their population is still growing and still fairly young, and their economic power is peaking, that they have the ability to build up their conventional and nuclear capability to go to the United States and say, we are no longer in a position of inferiority. In the nuclear world, we have done exactly what you and the Russians did. We maintain a large nuclear force. China actually has what they say is a no first use policy. They say, we will not be the first to use nuclear weapons. And what does that mean? That means that we might need to be prepared to face off conventionally against China in their backyard, right? Unless we are prepared to trade Taiwan for Boston. I don't have a really good tea, you know, maybe Tacoma. then deterrence will work on both of us. And if China decides that it's going to invade to capture Taiwan, then are we prepared to provide them with the military capability and to defend Taiwanese territory, even if it means we get into a conventional war with China? Well, I can't answer that question for you, but currently, that's U.S. policy. And if we don't defend a partner, what does it say to our allies in Japan and South Korea or in Europe if we're prepared to let one of these partners or allies go down the drain? Now, Taiwan is a little bit of a unique case because they're not recognized internationally as a full-blown country. They were, in fact, part of China before the revolution in 49. We've sort of played this diplomatic game where we accept that we have relations with China, who's the formal representative of China internationally since 1972, and Nixon restarted relations with them. But there are countries who recognize Taiwan as an independent state. Mm-hmm. They are a democracy, and we do have a partnership with them, including military assistance. So it would be different if China were to invade South Korea or Japan, but not to the Taiwanese. And our allies would view it in a way that wouldn't really show a difference. So this dynamic is the one that's adding to our problem with Russia. But wait, it gets worse. The United States, up until today, has said we need to maintain enough nuclear weapons so that we can deter the Russians. And if we can do that, because the Chinese nuclear arsenal is fairly small, we can take on the Russians and deal with China with whatever we have left over. Maybe, God forbid, we have a nuclear war with Russia, but we have residual nuclear forces we could surge in a crisis. Or if we don't have a war with Russia, because their forces are so much larger, we know that we have enough that we could handle this smaller challenge of China. In the world of nuclear deterrence, that parity, that rough equivalency with Russia has been enough. But in a world where China builds up in 10 or 20 or 30 years, and they have 1,500 or 2,500 weapons, in addition to the 3,000 or 4,000 that Russia has, how many nuclear weapons does the United States need to maintain a deterrent relationship? Go ahead, pick a number, and I guarantee you it will be just as accurate as the one that Strategic Command picks. Because it's based on belief. It's a subjective assessment. One of the things that the nuclear weapons community has done is create this math as if it were Newtonian, as somehow linked to the elemental operation of the universe, and said, this is the number. When in fact, it's all about whether or not you think numbers or specific types of capabilities or modes of deployment are critical to demonstrating intent. Deterrence is about influencing your adversaries. How do I convince you that I care about this as much, if not more, than you do? And for the United States in the world of nuclear deterrence, that often comes down to numbers. But China can churn out nuclear weapons, no problem. Does that mean they care more about it than we can? We don't have the ability to produce new nuclear weapons in the United States right now. We can produce a couple a year if we really had to. We're trying to build more. But the Chinese could probably build 20, 50, 100 a year if they really tried. Does that mean they care more? Of course not. Intent is about how it impacts us individually and how it affects us collectively as a country. And it's easy for me to say, I care about Europe. I care about my friends in Japan or South Korea or my wife's family in Taiwan, and that should be enough. But of course, presidents are the ones who make that decision, and presidents, as we've learned, can sometimes be unstable or irrational or have different value systems or care about different things, right? So that dynamic is a problem. But how we deter in a world where China and Russia have together more nuclear weapons than we do is a problem. And it's a problem for the following reason, and then I'll begin to wrap up. We've told our allies for generations, don't worry, if it really gets bad, we'll nuke them. Don't build nuclear weapons yourselves, you don't need them. Germany, Italy, Sweden, we'll use our nuclear weapons to protect you. The French didn't buy that, they had their own nuclear weapons. The British were involved in our nuclear weapons program, so they had their. But for the rest of the world, that's worked pretty well. Taiwan tried to build nuclear weapons in the 1970s. We talked them out of it. South Korea tried to build nuclear weapons in the 1980s, and again in the 2000s, we talked them out of it. Japan had an interest in nuclear weapons before they joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty in the 1970s. We talked them out of it. Sweden had a nuclear weapons program. We convinced them that our skin was in the game. We did it with our conventional capability, and we said, don't worry, we have enough nuclear weapons that when push comes to shove, we'll use them. Well, when our allies say, well, wait a second, you've got 3,000, the Russians have 3,000, and the Chinese have 3,000, who's more important, China or Russia? Are you going to protect South Korea? And if so, how do we know that you can protect us? By that logic, the one we have promulgated for 50 years, we need to have as many nuclear weapons as China and Russia combined, roughly. That's the argument that's being made by the people who believe nuclear weapons are valuable and enduring and have low cost. But what happens when we say to Russia and China, you've each got 3,000, so we have 6, but they have hot production facilities. What's to prevent China from saying, okay, you got 6, we'll go 6, right? We're both bluffing at the poker table with unlimited funds. Somebody else's money, our grandkids' money. Keep betting. That's the dynamic that has played out in the past, unless you believe the United States collective political judgment has dramatically improved over the last 50 years. That's likely to be the logic that we're going to see play out. And so that's why when people ask me in my role at Global Zero, are you serious? What do you mean zero? How are you going to get to zero? The first thing you do when you're in a hole is you stop digging. The United States has more nuclear weapons currently than we need to deter Russia. We have tried for several years to go to China and say, look, don't do this. Let's talk about nuclear weapons. And what the Chinese have said, you come down to our level and we'll talk. But we're not going to negotiate from a position of inferiority. If it's good for you, why isn't it good for us? They literally say, we've never used nuclear weapons against another country. That's the argument. Putin says the same thing. He's like, why should you believe in the United States? We didn't use nuclear weapons against Japan, they did. Now, I don't buy those arguments, I find them offensive, but that's the dialogue that we're in. And so, from our perspective at Global Zero, and personally, I believe, this is not a question of whether technically we know how to get rid of nuclear weapons. We actually have developed lots of transparency procedures where we could, with the right amount of political will, agree with other countries to get rid of these things. And we would have questions about verification, and when you get to very low numbers, you know, if you cheat and have one extra, that really matters. But right now, we got 12,000, right? The one stray one doesn't worry me. But it's not a question of whether we have the technical capacity to do this. It's about the political will and the dynamics in global security, where everybody, every country that has nuclear weapons is saying, these things don't seem so bad. In fact, they seem like they might be pretty useful. Or at the very least, they might have some utility and I don't see any downside to it. And that's true in South Asia, it's true in China, it's true in Europe, in France, in the United Kingdom, it's true in the United States, and it's probably true in Israel, right? When they look at Iran or Saudi Arabia developing nuclear capabilities, they probably think, you know, it's probably a good thing that we have this capability in our basement. And in that world, Global Zero can draw attention to the problem, but we can't fix it, right? That's a political problem. We can try to drive political actors, we can try to create public attention, we can try to convince you that when you vote for your senators or congressmen, that that's the issue you should care about. And actually, one of your senators, Angus King, is quite good on these issues. But that's not the current dynamic among Republicans or Democrats in office. Right now, the dynamic is China is a growing danger, Russia's a growing danger, and in addition to spending a lot of money on conventional and cyber and intelligence and satellites, we need nukes. And in the end, we're going to end up in a place where we have a lot of nuclear weapons and we have no improved security. And we will not have any choice but to figure out how to talk to these countries and work out some stable environment where we agree to stop building and then try to figure out how to come back down. That's the lesson from my point of view of the end of the Cold War. We finally recognized there was no such thing as nuclear superiority, right? The headline that has been pushed is that Ronald Reagan won the Cold War by spending the Soviet Union into oblivion. But it was Gorbachev who recognized that spending more and more money on nuclear weapons didn't bring any additive security. And Ronald Reagan talked a lot about nuclear abolition because he recognized that these things were unusable. And when we recognize that they're unusable, then we start to figure out how to get rid of them. But as long as they have any perceived utility, you're going to have to invite me back next year or some other nuclear expert that George helped mentor and inspire the year after that, because these weapons are going to be involved in geostrategic affairs, and they're not going to go away anytime soon. So I would tell you that I've got a really optimistic end line, but you knew what you were getting into when you invited a nuclear weapons expert up here. I hope it was at least useful, and with that, I'm really happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, John. We're going to be collecting questions from our members and guests. In the meantime, I always ask a question of my own just to get things rolling. You didn't talk a lot about what next step. You said kind of what the world situation is, but what is the next step to getting at least to talking to the Russians and the Chinese? In the Cold War, arms control talks were kind of a main channel of discussion, even though we disagreed on a lot of other stuff. Can we get back to that, or where are we going to go?
So the answer on the Russians is easier, I think, than the Chinese. The United States suspended the strategic nuclear talks we had with Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. We didn't cancel them. We said that these were suspended, that it's very difficult in this political environment to try to talk with Russia. We need a credible partner. So the reason they phrased it that way is they wanted to see whether Putin might lose or decide that he wanted to come back to the table as part of an endgame on Ukraine that involved nuclear discussions with the United States. That problem has gotten more complicated because Putin is now an indicted war criminal. And the United States generally, as a rule, does not sit down with indicted war criminals to talk about stuff. I suspect that if Putin made it clear he was prepared to talk to us, we would find some way around that, right? We would talk to his military, or we would talk to his foreign ministry. You know, I think President Biden would care enough about that opportunity if it was seen as being sincere that we would do that. The problem with the Chinese is I think they've decided, we'll get back to you when we're at your level. President Biden has now on 3 occasions spoken directly to President Xi and said, we have to talk about strategic nuclear weapons. Doesn't have to be about restrictions and limiting your numbers, but we have to talk about transparency and doctrines and crisis management. And every time Xi has said, okay, I agree to that, Biden has said, okay, who's your person that we should talk to? Xi says, go talk to this guy. And when the Secretary of State follows up, that guy doesn't reply. And when the Secretary of Defense contacts this guy, that guy doesn't reply. That's the Chinese way of saying thanks, but no thanks. And so there is no pathway right now. I would argue we had a pathway probably in the Obama administration. Had we done some things differently, we might have been able to talk to the Chinese. But I think now we're probably likely to just have nothing better to do but to plan for when they're prepared to pick up the phone.
One thing I know we were worried about for a long time, and should still be, is a third country using a weapon and dragging it, the major powers into it. How about the non-state threat? And you didn't address that at all, of nuclear development by a non-state actor.
So this was an animating threat during the Obama administration. George and I worked very closely with a woman, Laura Holgate, who's now our ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and actually a neighbor of mine in Arlington. She has a really good chili party every year, like five different types. It's pretty good. She helped organize four nuclear security summits in 2010, 12, 14, and 16 that helped secure enough uranium and plutonium around the world to make hundreds of nuclear weapons. A lot of the stuff was either sent to the United States or to other countries, downblended or eliminated, because we worried that this intersection between terrorism and the availability of nuclear materials could create a threat. We haven't, at least as far as I track, and you should talk with people like the counterterrorism experts you'll have, we haven't seen the growth of non-state actors to the point where they are capable of operating in territory and developing this type of technology themselves, or in acquiring those sort of material through black market theft or transfers. We worry about it, and we spend a lot of time through the intelligence apparatus to try to track it down. But I think the assessment is it's a much lower level threat now that Al-Qaeda has been largely defeated and dispersed, that ISIS is less active. But we do worry about uncontrolled territory in Africa and Syria and elsewhere where this might be a problem. I think we worry much more about the chemical and biological threat because a lot of that is more readily available. One of the axioms in nuclear security issues is if you don't have the nuclear materials, you can't build a nuclear weapon. Fortunately, this stuff doesn't grow on trees. But literally, biological and chemical weapons do grow on trees. I mean, you have to purify them, but you can extract it from nature. And so we worry a lot more about that. But on the nuclear side, we just haven't seen as much indicators that it's as big a problem as it used to be. We hope.
Yeah, nuclear weapons have been around for a long time, of course. And the question is, how does the domestic American political landscape play into the evolving evolution of U.S. nuclear policy? And is that more important now than it was 50 years ago?
Yeah. It's a great question. We actually spent a lot of time at Global Zero trying to think through how do we reach and mobilize the public? If you poll people in the United States, they support elimination of nuclear weapons around the world by a large margin. They oppose the use of the nuclear weapons by the United States unless we've been attacked with the use of a nuclear weapon. They oppose spending $50 billion a year on nuclear weapons when you could be spending it on other military or non-military efforts. But how do you get those people who say they believe those things to actually act? I got involved in this field when George was running the world back in the 1980s. I was a student involved in the nuclear freeze movement in New York City and got motivated because it was a palpable, substantive issue. It was on the headlines every day, and people felt that enough was enough, and they decided to take action and do something about it. And you can see how that not only influenced the domestic political landscape in Congress, but eventually Ronald Reagan himself, the ultimate Cold Warrior, recognized that he needed to plug into and capture that public narrative. He became an abolitionist because he recognized it was a salient political issue. It's why people care about environmental issues today. It's because that has become more prevalent and more salient. We don't have the landscape and the dialogue about nuclear issues, and it's why I'm here, because every chance I get to talk to individuals who can then influence their crowds, I think that's worth doing, but we need to do it on a much larger scale, and it is harder to do it today than it was, I think, 30 or 40 years ago, in part because there are a lot of issues that scare the crap out of people, right? I mean, I help set the doomsday clock, and it's hard to go, we're almost at midnight, we're getting closer to midnight, next year it's gonna be even closer, you know, it's dark, right? You should worry about this, because we now talk about multiple issues, we have to. Climate change is an existential threat. Disinformation and the use of technology to manipulate publics is a catalyst for these existential threats. And nuclear is an existential. And increasingly, biological is factoring into our calculations. And in the 1970s and 80s, all we had to worry about were nuclear weapons. It was just a much sweeter, nicer time.
Does climate change and the changes that are going to occur in the world have any influence on the nuclear threat? Does it make it greater because countries become more unstable?
Yeah, I mean, there's one aspect that definitely has an impact on nuclear that comes from climate, which is the renewed interest and support for nuclear power in the world, right? So many of the technologies used in building nuclear power plants are relevant if you want to build a nuclear weapon and vice versa. They're not quite exchangeable, but they're dual use in nature is the language in the business. And so if you want to run a nuclear reactor, you have to get some enriched uranium. Well, if you further enrich it up to higher levels of uranium-235, it's then more usable in a nuclear weapon. When you run a nuclear reactor, it produces plutonium. And if you separate out that plutonium, you can use that for a nuclear weapon. So we have to rebuild, since we haven't been building new nuclear power plants for many decades, we have to rebuild the export control systems and the inspection and safeguard systems that ensure if these technologies are going to spread, that they don't add to the nuclear threat. But there's a larger geopolitical challenge, and we talked about this before, that as climate change drives political instability, will that create opportunities or temptations by countries to use nuclear weapons to their advantage? We haven't seen it yet. If you look at South Asia, where they're facing major implications for climate change, nuclear weapons haven't been interesting to Pakistan because of climate change. They've been interested because of a mismatch with India. India's worried about China. Iran is not developing nuclear weapons capabilities because of climate change. They're doing it for international respect and to deter other countries. But in the future, as large migration flows, as areas become uninhabitable, and that creates these tensions, will populists try to seize nuclear weapons as a way of controlling populations or gaining power? I think we have to worry about that, but so far we haven't seen it as a driver.
Thank you. I have several questions here that are on the same similar theme. And do nuclear weapons have a shelf life? And are they going to degrade over time so we don't have to worry? Or is everybody producing them?
Yeah. Nuclear weapons are not shelf stable. Different countries make nuclear weapons differently. The Soviets built their nuclear weapons so that every 10 years they had to take them apart and rebuild them. They always had a hot production complex. We built our nuclear weapons to last about 30 years, and we currently have some nuclear weapons that we've had in the system for about 50 years, because we build our nuclear weapons really well. We're quite good at it. We have really good scientists. But there's some elements that over time, I want to use the Hunt for October joke, you know, some things in here don't react well to bullets. Some things in nuclear weapons don't do well over time. One of the elements is that we designed our nuclear weapons to have a little extra boost using tritium. Tritium is a light form of hydrogen, or a heavy form of hydrogen, and is really good at producing a lot of extra neutrons. And when you create a nuclear explosion, you need a lot of neutrons because that splits atoms and that releases energy. So we said, well, we can build these small nuclear weapons if we shrink them down, but then we inject a bunch of tritium in the middle. The problem is that tritium has a half-life of about 13 years. So that means every 13 years, there's half as much material, and then it halves again in 13. Did I get that right, George?
That's
half-life?
Right. You're right.
So every so often, we have to produce more tritium and refill them. There is an effort to try to refurbish U.S. nuclear weapons, and we've been engaged in that. They're called life extension programs, and we actually spend about $11 billion a year doing that work at the U.S. Department of Energy, where we take weapons apart, we check them, there's a little bit of rust there, that screw isn't where it's supposed to be, and we try to clean them up. The question becomes, at what point are those weapons unreliable? At what point do you need a whole new weapon? And that's a debate. The scientists will argue how many angels can fit on the head of a pin over and over. The fact is, though, that we have lots of different types of nuclear weapons. And so even if one fails, we have backups. And even if that one fails, we have backups. However, I'm a little bit unique in the disarmament community because I actually believe the United States should be spending a lot of money to maintain the safety and security of our nuclear weapons. When we eventually get to our last nuclear weapon, we are going to have really, really good confidence that that weapon works. Because the fewer you have, the more reliable it needs to be. But ironically, that doesn't mean it's going to be the race car of nuclear weapons, right? That means it's going to be the Mack truck of nuclear weapons. It's going to be over-designed. It's not going to have a lot of bells and whistles. It'll just be a big, dumb bomb, but it will work when we have to.
And we hear a lot recently about Russia's new delivery systems and new delivery capabilities. Is that becoming more of a significant factor than the number of weapons? How you can deliver them?
Yeah, there are three things that the Russians are doing that are new. The first is that they have developed a long-range underwater torpedo with a nuclear warhead. And when George and I were in government, this was among the most secret stuff classified. Even Donald Trump didn't have this stuff in his office. It was so secret. And we couldn't talk about it. We had to go into special rooms just to have a conversation. And then Vladimir Putin gave a speech in, I think, 2013 or 14, where he basically laid all this out in public. We're like, great, we can finally talk about it, you know? So they're developing this long-range torpedo with the idea that it could launch across the Pacific, travel faster than we could track it and intercept it, and it could destroy a port like Los Angeles or Seattle. Why? They worry that they're long-range missiles on land might not get through our missile defenses, or that their submarines, which we track, we could blow out of the water before they might be able to launch anything. And their bombers are pretty slow and have propellers. So, you know, they're trying to figure out ways that they can ensure they could get nuclear weapons to us if the other systems fail. Same thing with this second category of cruise missiles that actually have small little nuclear power generators to run the turbofan. The Soviets were really good at building space reactors to power their satellites that ran on small amounts of plutonium, and they're using that technology to fuel these cruise missiles. Cruise missiles tend to fly pretty slowly, so we worry about sending small nuclear reactors circling the world, but again, that's the technology. The one that really worries me the most, and my guess is that others who study this agree with me, is what are called hyperglide systems. If you hear the word hyperglide, you might think, oh, these are new, super, super fast missiles. In fact, hyperglide missiles travel more slowly than regular old intercontinental ballistic missiles. Those might travel as many as 20, 25 times the speed of sound when they're coming in. What hyperglide missiles do is that they can maneuver as they're coming into their target. And if you have ballistic missile defenses, which look at the arc trajectory of an incoming missile, identify a point in space where the missile is going to be, and then fire the interceptor, and it takes 12 seconds to get there, a maneuverable warhead is really useful for evading that. And the Russians have spent a lot of time and money, as have we, developing this new technology. That worries me the most because, again, it's built around this idea that the Russians are no longer comfortable, that they have a reliable deterrent. And if that's true, not only will they rely on these different systems, but they're more likely to rely on things like launch on warning. Or if they see an incoming attack or believe an incoming attack is coming, they might launch preemptively. And the problem is that their radars and our radars are imperfect. We have had multiple instances in the past where the Russian nuclear system went on alert because of a Norwegian sounding rocket. Or we thought the Russians were preparing to attack, but actually it was an exercise. Or in this case, it was a training tape that was put into our simulators, but that actually ran like a real threat. And so the fact that we are increasingly on edge, when you add in the risk of miscalculation or technical glitch, worries me a lot.
Well, first, I'm going to apologize. We haven't gotten to all the questions.
I talk a lot. You said I was
run
dynamic.
Out of time, so I apologize to the... to our members and guests who are here. I want to ask one more question, which I, do you believe we missed an opportunity to get rid of to rid ourselves and the world of nuclear weapons when the Soviet Union broke up?
Yes. Thank you. I was not in government at the time. I joined my first government assignment in 1995, so I rely on what I hear from people like George and other people who were there and studied it at the time. Hindsight's always 20/20, right? But in 1991, or even before that, late 1980s, the top Soviet experts in the world were convinced that Gorbachev was a hoax. I won't call them out by name, but these are people you know and that have held senior most positions in the US government, are widely respected, and they got Gorbachev wrong. Now, I don't blame them for that, because we had just had 70 years of global competition against a country we were convinced was coming to eat our lunch. And I was studying as a young Sovietologist in the late 1980s, going to grad school, and learning about the 15 Russian Soviet military districts, because that's what you studied. But the reality is that in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it collapsed. They couldn't protect their nuclear weapons, they couldn't protect their nuclear materials, they couldn't feed their people, they couldn't provide pensions. Their conventional military just sat around and did nothing. We had an opportunity to push much more aggressively to lower numbers than the United States was prepared to do. And because we were not convinced that nuclear weapons were as dangerous as I think they were, we thought, and many people involved in security at the time, and this is not a Republican-Democrat issue, that everybody believed this, that nuclear weapons provided stability, and let's lead towards lower numbers, but let's hedge. And in fact, our nuclear policy at the time was called lead but hedge. And so we said we will try to go to lower numbers, we'll work to negotiate deals, but we're going to maintain enough weapons that if the geopolitical changes the geopolitical situation changes in ways to our disadvantage, we can always fall back on nuclear weapons. And I think looking back that was a big mistake. I think there are people who, not because they're bad people, they just view the world differently. They think nuclear weapons are fairly cost-free, both in terms of risk and in terms of economic and societal impact. They don't look at the environmental consequences of nuclear testing and nuclear mining and disposal. They don't look at the financial cost and the opportunity cost over time. And when mistakes happen, which they do, they say, well, we're getting better at it. We're really good. You know, we've prevented these things from being used for 75 years. It's worth the risk. And I tend to view it the other way, which is those costs are far too high. We keep getting lucky. And when nuclear deterrence fails, it is going to fail big. And that is the point at which we're all going to say, why did we think this was a good idea? I'd much rather, and I face a lot of criticism in Washington because it's counter to the conventional wisdom, a lot of criticism for saying, why don't we think big now? Why don't we challenge whether or not we really need to rebuild the entire Cold War nuclear arsenal in the United States to the tune of $1.75 trillion over the next 30 years, and maybe just go for half that? Let's just start at half, and then we'll see whether that works. So the answer is yes, I think we missed an opportunity.
Thank you very much, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, George.
And we can't let you get away without giving you one of the much coveted
Mid-Coast
Forum mugs. And so you can drink your morning latte.
Outstanding. I don't get lattes at home. I got to make just
regular coffee. Yeah, we made him one this morning.
That's great. Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
And thank you all so much for coming. Thanks, George. This is great.
Thank you. I've got Derek's here.